Mundy did a monologue that it really is time for Sheriff Susan Hudson to go. She needs to resign. Obviously, she hasn't. She's on the campaign trail. Never in my wildest dreams did I think that this campaign would take the turn that it has, and that we would characterize a prison escape of 10 inmates, 9 captured, 1 still at large, that has cost us tens of millions of dollars in cost to you, the taxpayers, to capture these individuals. And then on the heels of that, we release the wrong person who's still at large. So one at large from the original, another one still at large from the mistake, trying to call it a clerical error and the like. Well, there was a political forum the other night, and it was at the Blessed Trinity Catholic Church in Broadmoor, hosted by Step Up for Action Forum. And during the Q&A portion, there was a question that, do you find this suspicious, meaning the escape, and do you find the recent jailbreaks as politically motivated? Now, anybody with a half a lick of common sense, decency, credible leadership skills would just dispose of that question with one word. No. There's nothing political about this. But that's not what was said. The sheriff goes on this explanation that, you know, the jail's built in such a way it's impossible to get out without help. Well, that's not true, because they got out by a mistake the other day, without a doubt, and that's what happened that day. Now, we have a story to tell, she says. This isn't CSI New Orleans, where everything gets wrapped up in an hour. We've got to look at hundreds of hours of film, listen to phone calls. There's a lot being done to find out exactly what happened. So then the other candidates started to weigh in and really didn't give her a lot of space on that. The candidate, Parker, said, to insinuate that 10 guys that didn't want to be in jail turned the water off and did it for political reasons. And then Michelle Woodfork said what happened on May 16th was incompetence. It's poor leadership. It's poor management. She hit the nail on the head. And then another candidate said that Hudson ought to be charged with malfeasance. So when it came to the final statements, this wasn't enough, where she just didn't dispense with this silly question, which was more likely than not a plant. She says that the sheriff's office by nature is political. Sheriff's offices are political offices. Okay. She's going to give us a civics lesson. That does not accuse anyone of anything. But you have to understand, they are political offices. And the people in there are political. This is so disingenuous that we're going to leave that out there hanging. This is what desperate people do. And this is why I asked that she resign, because I didn't know that this was going to happen. But desperate people do desperate things. And typically what ultimately happens there is that the public at large is the one that suffers as a result of these desperation moves. This is absolutely a joke. This woman has no credibility. We knew that this was going to go down a path from the moment that she was elected that was not going to be a good path. We reserve judgment, but repeatedly over and over and over again, there's been missteps, mishaps, misspeaking, and I guess it was all political. And that doesn't even account for what words have come out of her mouth, right? And as I said Monday, when she says this is on me, it really is not. It's on the public at large because they're the ones really suffering the consequences. She's going to suffer the consequence of probably losing this election. No big loss there. I don't know a lot about the other candidates, but it can't be any worse, we hope. But the fact of the matter is that the appropriate thing to do is to dispense with that. It's a smokescreen. It's to get people out there thinking that there are folks that are not legitimate in their criticism of this candidate, of this office. And that maybe she's now being undermined by her own employees. I'll remind Sheriff Hudson of this. The employees of the sheriff's office have never elected a sheriff, and they're not going to unelect a sheriff. So to put out there this air that she's being undermined by her own office is absolutely ridiculous. That's what management is all about, managing people. Setting up systems, internal controls, making sure that there's adherence to them. So they don't embarrass the entity. They don't embarrass you as a political leader. Because truly, the office isn't political. You're the politician. You're the one that's political. The office doesn't have to be political at all. It can be as political as you allow it to be. And typically, when you allow it to be very political, you never know what the ultimate outcomes are going to ultimately be because you're no longer in control. Oftentimes, I was asked to speak to incoming sheriffs. And I would remind them of what a lot of folks that have written about leadership ultimately talked about relative to how they dealt with folks that work for them. I don't want you loyal to me. I want you loyal to the office, the entity. And that's where you've heard me borrow the phrase, the entity's interest always outweighs the individual. It's not about the elected leader. It's about the entity. It's about the office that serves the public at large. And again, we've not learned the lessons of what we've gone through. And I could go through the whole plethora of mishaps here over the period of time of her service for roughly 3.5 years now. All of it was political? Or was it just this escape of 10 inmates? Very embarrassing. I get it. But it's not political. She knows that. But she's acting out of desperation. And again, bringing shame to the office. I'm going to be shocked if this story doesn't go national. I mean, you know, I got to imagine it may even be talked about on Stephen Colbert. Who knows? I guess the next accusation is going to be that the 10 inmates were Republicans. I mean, you know, that we're now going to engage in partisanship as to how this escape actually came about. This is what happens when you have a level of incompetence, when you have an office that is messing up in every way, shape, or form. It's not their fault, it's hers. Because again, you're responsible for setting up the internal controls and everything else that goes along with that. And you have an obligation to step up and do the right thing each and every day. And that certainly is not engaging in a conversation at a forum to make people believe that this whole thing could have been politically motivated. And it, maybe you find it suspicious. And this investigation continues, not at a warp speed, by any stretch of the imagination, because there really hasn't been a lot revealed as it relates to some of the findings here. We've had some people charged. We hadn't had all the dots, all the I's dotted or the T's crossed yet, and we still wait. And I suspect it's not going to happen before the election, right? We all know that. She must think we're a fool. She's going to talk about the breadth and depth of this investigation that won't get revealed until after the election. And if she doesn't win, it won't get revealed probably until the new sheriff takes office. And that's just the way it's going to be. But we are allowing candidates, and again, that's why it's so important. Listen to what these candidates are saying. You know, one of the candidates said, and I don't even remember who it is, I don't hold the sheriff responsible for a jailbreak. What I hold the sheriff responsible for is the response to the jailbreak. What? I hold her for not knowing about the jailbreak for several hours. What are you talking about? I mean, you had a guard who unilaterally decided to leave their post to go eat. Now, what culture of in an employment arena would allow something like that to happen when you're responsible for watching inmates? What makes you think that you can do that? And where was mid-level supervision, and whether or not there was an approval process that you cannot leave your duty assignment unmanned? I suspect it's not the first time that the guard had done that, right? So it's not the fact that she didn't learn about it for hours. It's the fact that we've developed a culture there where it's very lackadaisical. We're not dotting the I's, crossing the T's. We're not doing what we're supposed to do. We're not adhering to the internal controls. We're not holding our own employees accountable. And it very well may be because we can't recruit enough, and we're not going to really take any disciplinary action against any of these people because we're afraid we're going to continue to go undermanned. So we compromise. We compromise the safety and security of the community at large, as opposed to doing the right thing and holding people accountable inside the jail. And this is what happens. So if anybody was motivated by political purposes, it was probably the sheriff. Because all of this was going to be very, very embarrassing, no matter what the outcome was going to be. Because we're either going to hear a story about an escape, or we're going to hear a story about stuff that's going on inside the jail, which we heard those stories repeatedly over and over and over again. And the consent decree folks and the monitors would bring it up all the time because we had no accountability. So we can put our head on our pillow tonight and take comfort in knowing that the outcome, according to the sheriff here, may be politics as usual, that this is all politically motivated, and it has nothing to do with execution or core competencies of our elected sheriff. All's good. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. There are some important findings from a recent cancer trends study that was conducted for the years 2015 to 2022. It was also conducted by the Louisiana Tumor Registry. And here to talk to us about it is Brad Wellens, Regional Manager, Tobacco Control and Prevention and the Louisiana Campaign for Tobacco-Free Living. Brad, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Newell. Actually, welcome back. I was on the Tommy Tucker Show earlier in April talking about the 10 years of Newell and smoke-free. So I'm very happy to be back and talk about this, which is talk about outcomes, you know, how smoke-free and those initiatives have proven to work.
So tell us about the outcomes that were revealed by this Cancer Trends study.
That's a good question. And what it was, like you said, you talked about it well, from 2015 to 2022, looking at two parishes, Orleans and Ouachita Parish up in North Louisiana, that that implemented smoke-free policies for that period of time. And so what they found was for those two parishes that had that long period of smoke-free policies in place, that the cancer-related, just what we call tobacco-related cancers, were 2.34% lower than the rest of Louisiana. In particular, lung cancer was over 4.5% lower than the rest of the state. And so what that shows us is by implementing these smoke-free policies, these parishes are healthier, particularly when it relates to how tobacco influences cancer and how it causes cancer.
So when we think about that, are we able to extract from the data, or does the data reveal the difference between firsthand smoke as opposed to secondhand smoke and the cancer incidence levels there, or incident rates
Yeah, that's a really good question, Norman. I don't think we can pull those things apart, but what we can say is because smoking has declined in the areas where we've implemented smoke-free policies, that with smoking decline, the cancer has declined. Also, as you point out, the incidence of their exposure to secondhand smoke here in New Orleans has gone from 85 to 90% in the bars and places they had secondhand smoke to virtually zero. And so we know that those two are combined. And, you know, we can't necessarily pull them apart, but the secondhand smoke, going smoke-free, influences the other. So if we do those policies, save lives both for secondhand smoke and for direct smoking.
Was there any thing to be gleaned from this study relative to vaping?
Yeah, that's a good question, Norman, and no. And I think the thing is other than the fact that vaping is a part of the secondhand smoke or a part of smoking, the studies really focus on the period before vaping really became big. And vaping didn't really rise into the national consequence until about 2016, 2017. So there might have been part of it, but again, we haven't done the scientific. We know that vaping causes a lot of illnesses, particularly in the short term, the exposure to chemicals and the exposure to things, they cause things like what we call popcorn lung, which is called EVALI in the scientific terminology. But there haven't been enough long-term studies as there have been on cigarettes to demonstrate that direct link to tobacco-related cancers and particularly to lung cancer.
What are the most recent studies revealing about vaping? I mean, there's been some studies that have been, you know, that have been in process for several years now. I've looked at some of them. I don't know of a single one that has a positive outcome.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And the thing is with vaping, what we do know and what those studies have revealed is that while what you're inhaling into your lungs is different, a little bit different from tobacco, you're still inhaling things like chemicals, glycols, and other carcinogenic chemicals. So we know that those chemicals cause the exposure. It's a matter of linking those, you know, to the actual vaping, and that's the problem. Is you know, in this work, Newell, that we're very excited about this. And these studies, you know, this was implemented back in 2015, these smoke-free laws. So we're only now learning about that these are really helping. And it's going to be the same thing with vaping. We're going to see these, as these more long-term studies come out, we're going to see these long-term effects. And we are almost positive that it's going to lead to some sort of cancer-related illnesses, because we've seen them in the way that those chemicals that are included in the vape have. We just can't directly tie it to vaping.
So the results of this study, we're able to glean that if the smoke-free ordinances are having an impact, What are you hearing from communities across the state? Because only about, 30% of Louisiana's population is currently protected by these indoor smoke-free laws. What are we hearing from jurisdictions that haven't imposed this? Is there a move towards doing this, and are they evaluating this study? What are you hearing from these group folks?
Yeah, that's a good question, Norman. And I think that what we're hearing is, A, one, a surprise that, you know, when we go in, a lot of people say, oh, my community isn't smoke-free. I thought it was. And we go, no, it's not. You still need to, there are still loopholes that need to be closed, and you're still exposed to secondhand smoke, a good percentage of your population is. And the second thing we're hearing is that a lot of people are concerned about, obviously, protecting their communities as a whole. And so we know that, you know, like, smoking is a part of it. And how do you protect, you know, your community from increased risk of cancer, from increased lung cancer, things like that? You have to, it's all part of it. It's part of nutrition, exercise, diet, reducing exposure. And one of those things is not smoking. And that's one of the easiest things. And the last thing we're hearing, Newell, is that people are very concerned about vaping. And they should be. And the reason is because it's an unknown. And we don't know what the companies and most of the vaping products that are on the market now are illegal, according to the FDA. The problem is it's a matter of enforcement because they're not enforcing it. So we have to try to enforce it at the state level, which is something that we're trying to do. But it's more about awareness than people can just voluntarily, you know, not smoke and not vape. And as long as they're aware of the consequences.
So, you know, we've heard a lot about secondhand smoke and all of this other, you know, and exposure levels and alike. We don't always talk about the significant economic impact. So let's talk about that. You know, obviously, what's at the forefront of a lot of people's mind as a result of the passage of the Big Beautiful Bill is some modifications relative to Medicaid eligibility, costs going up. We just heard the other day that a number of the medical insurers were caught a little bit off guard with their pricing relative to Medicare plans because of the cost of medical treatment going up significantly. Medical inflation is always pretty strong. Let's talk about the economic impact here, because it seems I remember big numbers being associated with this. And it seems that there's some huge upside opportunities.
Yeah, there is. And that's a great point, Norman. There is a lot of opportunity there because, as you said, you know, the economic impact of tobacco and the tobacco-related diseases and the health care that is needed to fight these diseases, it's much easier to do it on the prevention side than it is on the other side, because these costs are add up for Louisiana alone about $2 billion. And Medicaid, it's about...
So wait. Say that again. So in Louisiana, just tobacco-related health care costs are $2 billion annually?
Yep. It is. Because if you think about the tobacco-related cancer, and it's not just cancer. It's things like COPD. It's things like, you know, heart disease. It's other things, a peripheral artery disease, you know, things like that are caused by smoking. And for Medicaid, it's about $863 million. So if we have Medicaid cuts, that's going to be cut, and that's one of those direct effects. If we're not going to be able to, people that are on Medicaid are not going to be able to receive that treatment. I mean, per taxpayer, it's about a little bit over $1,400 a household annually in Louisiana. And
wait, so say that again. I lost you a second. Sorry. Say that again.
It's about a little bit over $1,400 per taxpayer household in Louisiana, and that's a lot. And
that's a huge number. We're a poor state.
It is.
I mean, that's a huge number.
That's exactly right. Even if you don't smoke, if you haven't had this, and think about, you know, that disproportionate on certain taxpayers, but all of us are paying for this. And one of the things that we know, that if we do smoke-free laws, if we have cessation interventions, if we don't smoke, then it's the prevention side. You know, one of the things about vaping and some of these new new tobacco products is that they're more nicotine now. They're more addictive. And so one of the things that we find is people need more what we call nicotine treatment. You know, like it's medicated, it's prescribed treatment. And that's the problem, is if we cut the interest, like you said, Medicare being cut, Medicaid being cut, if this is being cut, one of the things that's been cut is the prevention treatment. So there's an opportunity here, but it has to be on the prevention side, because if we wait until people have the symptoms, then it's way more expensive. So and as we're a healthy community, the healthier we are as a community, the more we attract residents who want to be there, the more businesses, and it creates a strong economy. We want to talk about some of the economic impact.
You know, we talk a lot about the economic impact of illicit drug use all the time. I'm curious, do you know whether or not this $2 billion annual number is larger than what it is relative to illicit drug use in Louisiana?
I don't.
Or and maybe that, you know, nationwide? Maybe nationwide? I mean, you would admit, yeah, we talk more about the economic impact of illicit drug use than we do of smoking. My gut tells me that this number is probably larger than what it cost us in this state for illicit drug use.
That's a good point. And it probably is. I don't have that specific number, but that's a very logical point to make there.
I mean, it furthers the argument of what the impact is here and the byproduct of the tobacco addiction.
Right.
You know, I mean,
the thing. We're just seeing that. You know, cigarettes have a certain amount of tobacco in it. And we base how we measure nicotine based on essentially one pack of cigarettes or one cigarette. And the new vaping products, the new smokeless tobacco products and things like that have in excess of multiple packs of cigarettes. There are some vaping products out there that have as many as the effect of six packs of cigarettes in one box of the little pods that you use for vapes. And so that is incredibly scary in terms of trying to help people quit. And the amount of vape that you're pulling into your lungs.
Do we know whether or not the addictive nature or impact of vaping is less than or greater than just normal cigarettes? Do we have any idea?
Those studies have just started to come out. We don't have any Louisiana-specific data. One of the things we do know is that it's much harder for people to quit now than it was when people quit cigarettes. I mean, my father was a lifetime smoker, three packs a day. It took him multiple attempts to quit. And I can only imagine what it would be now, as you know, if you had a teenager or someone in your family that vapes and they are vaping these much more addictive, much higher nicotine levels than it was when you were smoking cigarettes.
Yeah. Interesting conversation. It'll be interesting to see what other jurisdictions do, because on the parish by parish level, there's really not many parishes that have gone smoke free, right?
Right.
In Louisiana?
It's 38 of our parishes, and it's like I said, it's 30% of the population that only 30% have gone smoke free. And obviously, that needs to change because it's not just, I mean, there's an impending storm in a long term sense from vaping. I mean, we know that cigarette smoking is coming down. But it is basically held steady, Norman. I mean, we saw it decrease and it popped up after the pandemic, and it's basically holding steady. And one of the problems is that people are vaping and they're going to cigarettes. Some people they smoke multiple things, and so we know that smoke-free laws is not only they're preventing the secondhand exposure, but they also are really helping people. Oh, I need to quit. This is not a place where I smoke. And basically addressing that. And we're here to help people do that.
Exactly. Brad Wellens, Regional Manager, Tobacco Control and Prevention and the Louisiana Campaign for Tobacco-Free Living. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate you sharing the Cancer Trends Study by the Louisiana Tumor Registry. We appreciate same. Have a great week.
Thank you, Norman. Appreciate it.
We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Well, you know that summer's coming to an end, right? When we here at WWL start offering and the opportunity to win tickets to the Saints' first preseason game. You know, I'll be here 8 years in September, and I always know that my summer's coming to an end when we start offering up the tickets. Well, we are. If you want to win tickets to the Saints' first preseason game against Jacksonville, Sunday, August 17th in the Caesars Superdome, you could score two premium tickets to go to the game and cheer on the black and gold in style. Entering is a breeze. Starting today, go to WWL.com/contest for your shot at a pair of tickets to the Saints preseason showdown against the Jaguars from Odyssey and Saints Radio WWL. And I think the season actually starts earlier than that because that is, I think, the first home game. And also, as we get into the heart of the hurricane season, everybody worries about losing power. I don't, but WWL wants to help ease your concerns. That's why we teamed up with Craig's Electrical and Generator Service to offer you the chance to win a portable generator. We're talking about a Generac GP6500 portable generator, total value almost $1,000. Go to WWL.com/contest for your chance to win backup power from Craig's Electrical and Generator Service, because when the power goes off, Craig definitely comes on in WWL Louisiana Official Emergency Management Station. I created that partnership with myself and Craig a long time ago, and I have been incredibly happy. There's a lot coming out, a lot of news coming out about summer camp. I don't know about you, but I really like listening to Kellen Moore. I love his analysis. I love kind of the way that he articulates the information about what's going on, what some of the realities are that they're facing, the competition that they have right now at a lot of different positions. It's been very interesting. I'd love hearing the players talk about the heat and humidity that's out there. If you can play here outdoors, you can play anywhere outdoors. That's for certain. Things are ramping up quickly. And we're getting closer and closer to that first preseason game. And we're getting closer and closer to all of those times where you start having to make decisions about who stays, who goes, how that's going to impact the team. The team is going to be young at many different positions. A lot of new faces, a lot of new names. I was kind of looking through the list the other day, and it was amazing how many names I didn't recognize, right? And I'm sure you're going through that same process. But you can kind of feel the momentum building up for this season, right? I don't know that people are making Super Bowl predictions like we did for so long. But nonetheless, it would be nice if we could have more W's than L's and have to put what our expectations are, kind of eat a dose of reality there. I think it's fair to say that no one really likes to use this term, rebuilding, but we are in many respects, and that's okay. Got a lot of new talent in the coaching circles here, as well as new talent from the players as well. A lot of things have changed. A lot of folks finding their way, developing their pace, the momentum of the team. It seems like things are moving forward in a very ordered and structured way. The head coach seems to be very much in control of what's going on. A little different dynamic, different approach being brought here. It's kind of nice to see. I actually always respected Dennis Allen. A lot of people didn't. I did. I liked him as a man. I liked him as an individual. And this is going to be something new. So we shall see. I like what I'm seeing thus far, and we definitely wish them the best. I hadn't spent a lot of time talking about it because a lot of things are moving and changing real fast. People coming in, going out. The announcement of the DB that was leaving, that decided to retire the other day, and kind of was a shock to a lot of people. So it's just an indication of how things are changing. Folks evaluating whether or not they can really bring something to the team, whether they can bring that 100%, that level of play that they have in the past. I love when players, because it really is about leadership and about understanding and looking at oneself critically in the mirror. You hear me say that all the time. When these players decide, I can't bring it at that level any longer. The NFL got the best that I had to give, and it's time for me to move on. And I really respect the decision that was made, albeit it might have been a little late, and maybe the Saints would have liked it a little early. I don't know. I don't know all the strategies of what goes on with NFL teams. But once again, I thought it was mature approach, and we'll see. We'll see what's actually going to happen. All right, we'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. After the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Matt Wolf, VP of Communications, Greater New Orleans, Inc. We'll talk about a number of issues of things that are going on around the Greater New Orleans area. And we'll also visit with Sonny LaBeouf, Market Vice President, Cox New Orleans, about a new collaboration with Delgado Community College and Small Business Leadership Academy. We'll be right back.